Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
What do you think of the new theme music? It's a little bit more lo-fi than we're used to. We are in the tunnels that go underneath Hyde Park Corner. We're here for very good reason. I'm here with Ben Judah, and he's the author of This Is London.
Hi.
Now, I know you slept down here a little bit for the writing of the book we're about to talk about, and we'll sketch out what the book is before we dive in too deep. But was this guy playing when you were trying to sleep?
No, he wasn't, but I spent a lot of time with another musician who lived down here, who was a fiddler who had come from Romania to busk and beg in the area. And I'm really interested in these tunnels that run under Hyde Park Corner because I think that they are a frontier between two of the Eastern Europeans and worlds in London we never see. One, which is the world of Roma beggars and Romanian kind of labourers who land at Victoria Coast Station, which is so nearby, and the other is the world of the super rich, which is just above us, because Belgravia and Mayfair are just minutes away, where bricks are worth hundreds of thousands of pounds each, and whole mansions are now the bitcoins of kleptocrats. And this is a weird liminal space, which at night turns into a street sleeper city or an almost Romanian village of beggars living down here, and I join them.
Well, multiple villages, in fact.
And multiple, yeah. All the way up Park Lane towards Speaker's Corner at the top are different clusters of Roma from different parts of Romania who don't trust each other, who are from different backgrounds and different villages here for sometimes slightly different, sometimes similar reasons. And there's something quite spooky about the paintings on the walls here. Firstly, because they're these line drawings of the glories and the splendours of Victorian London, men in top hats, red coats, and the poverty is edited out of every one of them. There are these images of Park Lane in 1804 and of Buckingham Palace and Marble Arch, only with the wealthy there. I think that's sort of spooky. When I was living down here with the Roma, we'd often sort of fall asleep discussing these line drawings of what they meant. What were they? And they keep on asking me about Buckingham Palace above. Who exactly was she, the queen that lived there? How much power did she have? Is she like the president of Romania? Is she the person who has all the power in Britain or not? And why doesn't she do anything for us?
I wonder if we need to draw some lines or at least acknowledge some spectra before we go too much further in, because we're going to be talking about different groups of people, and we're necessarily, I guess, going to be talking about immigration. That seems to play quite a large part in the book, This Is London. But of course, not all immigrants end up sleeping in a tunnel down here, as indeed not all reporters do.
No. Well, the idea of the book was to tell a portrait of the new London, and London's become a sort of immigrant megacity over the last few decades. And London wasn't always like this. If you go back to 1931 and you look at the census, just 2.7% of the London population was born abroad. Today, the official figure is 37%. And if you take in immigrants and their children, over 55% of London is an immigrant or his families and children or grandchildren. And that's an extraordinary transformation, turning what was, even though it was the capital of an empire, in some ways quite parochial, northern European city into a kind of unreal, almost unimaginable place from the perspective of the 1930s or the 1950s. So the idea of the book was to write about this like a foreign correspondent, to approach it in the same way that one would write about Russia, or one would write about India, or about Israel or Palestine, and to go there and actually do the reporting, to go and listen to the people of this new city to tell their stories, to see it from their point of view. So the book has 25 chapters, and each of them are from the point of view of different immigrants. Some of them super rich, some of them super poor, some of them who live in Mayfair mansions, some of them who live on the street, some of them who have been transformed and made by London into what they always dreamed of being, others who've been broken by London. And the idea was to write a book which reflected the real London, which is not anymore the middle class or the upper class or the working class, old English, British London of EastEnders or of BBC costume dramas.
Well, EastEnders is actually quite an interesting idea. If we were to look at, for example, Whitechapel, then we obviously have a history of a wave after wave of immigration, and the idea of people arriving from overseas and setting up camp and displacing the previous lot wouldn't be at all strange to them. So is this just a question of where we draw the circle?
Well, if you look back at London history, it's very interesting that there are, of course, have always been in London, ever since Roman times, traders from the Middle East, Lombard bankers, French cheese salesmen. There have always been foreigners in the city who made it their home and become Londoners. But that was usually concentrated in very specific places. It was concentrated in the 18th and 19th century. It was heavily concentrated in Whitechapel. And if you went there, you would have found, from the 18th century onwards, a world of Sephardic and Ashkenazi Jewish tailors and tradesmen, a world of Bengali Lascars who were there from the 18th century. But it was quite a small percentage of London demographically. It was not the majority of the city. And London, in terms of percentages, was much less multicultural than Paris, than Alexandria, than Istanbul, than any of the cities that Britain would have ruled, like Calcutta. So I think there has been a real change in London.
Beyond the reportage of it, and even then I could ask the question, what's your stake in the investigation?
I think that it's really important to think about cities and to work out what cities actually are and how they work. And I think that we approach them not with as much depth and as much analysis, which is why I love the Londoners, because it goes into such depth. And London is so huge and so complicated. It's got a population larger than Austria or larger than Israel. And you wouldn't go, "I live in Austria," with that kind of declamatory, "I know everything about it" sense that people would about London. And I don't think people really live in cities. People say, "I live in a city," but in fact what people live in is in very specific, tiny, tiny, tiny little transport grooves, one or two pubs, one or two friends' homes you might go to, very repetitive, tight little coils. And if you open your iPhone, if you've got one, and you flip around the back of it, Apple's got this quite eerie tracking service it does of your movements, and you can see these maps that your iPhone is making of where you go. And it is shocking how repetitive it is. And in those grooves, I think you miss the extraordinary complexity of London and how there are so many parallel different worlds. This is what my book's about. My book was my kind of obsession to acquaint myself with where I actually live and to find out as much about it and to see as much as I could of it, to see what's life like in Polish London, in Nigerian London, in Filipina London, what's life like in Pakistani London, what's life like in kind of oligarch London, in Saudi London, in Russian London. So I guess my stake in it was just how curious I was, because I increasingly get the sense that because there aren't enough local reporters, there isn't enough actual reporting going on in the British media in general, and because the media is not structured in that way, there's no like breaking news from Walthamstow in the way that there is from Cairo or Gaza.
Actually, I think that's rubbish. I think there's breaking news all over the place, if one cares to look. I think
Sure.
One of the problems, it seems to me, is the local newspaper business model, which seems to be a franchised out string of local newspapers, which vary little from one title to the next. Basically, a vehicle for the ad.
It's so depressing. And I think that was one of the reasons that I wrote this book, to try and to get as many of the stories and the senses of what London is like. I don't think we get any more. The inspiration to write it came from a lot of my thoughts about journalism. I used to work as a foreign correspondent. I worked in Russia, and when I was working in Russia, I was shuttling to and fro across Siberia and the Caucasus. I had a chance to meet sort of crooked ministers and sort of alcoholic policemen and the occasional saintly figure. And doing it, I realised that the foreign correspondent isn't just an increasingly rare job, it's also like a way of writing. It's a style in which you go out, you go away from the newsroom, you get out from the press conference, you go away from the seat of power, and you bring in the voices of normal people and little people, and you show what does it look like from the slums of Makhachkala, what does Russia look like from the mining colonies of the north. And when I came back to live in Britain, I started opening newspapers. We don't write about our country that way. We just have polls, 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 more and more and more polls, 50% this, 42% that, 48, 52.
More and more polls is one of the major issues as far as certain portions of the polity go.
Of course, and we have interviews with politicians or profiles of politicians or repackaged press releases, and there's not enough actual reporting. There's not enough going into a society that's changed a lot more and a lot faster than I think most people realise, especially London.
I mean, this has been a prime time for your book to come out, hasn't it? What with the referendum, it couldn't be more timely. And yet, what I didn't hear too much of in all of the debates that were going on around immigration were individual stories. There were big statistics, there were emotions churned up, but relatively few, actually. They were simple and straightforward, and this is what we think. There didn't seem to be too much in the way of exemplary material to base our decisions on.
I think a lot of it comes from the unfortunate way that we tend to write about immigrants, and both
how do we tend to write about immigrants?
I think both the left and the right, and I think both people who are pro-immigration, anti-immigration, have a tendency to objectify these people and to make them morality tales. Either they're pure victims, or they're pure baddies. They're turned into numbers. They're turned into sort of faceless statistics, changing our country, or like a mass of people who are described as swarms or any of this sort of animalistic language, either within or without of our society. So what I wanted to do in this book was to take 25 Londoners who'd made this city their home, who come from abroad, and to just see it from their eyes, and also like not to censor it. I think that we live in a very censorious period, and because of Twitter and trolling and Facebook and all of these different campaigns about language, which I think have substituted for the left a lot of actual campaigns about changing the economy, people are very nervous about saying the right or the wrong thing. I think that as journalists, often without realizing it, we sculpt our interviewees when we present them, clip little bits out, and we're just going to take that out. That might be, the readers might not like that. So what I wanted to do in this book was present what people say and how they really say it, like, bald.
This must make you ideal for not just being sculpted and buffed up, but having the agenda of the interviewer projected all over you. You're writing about this hot-button topic.
Oh.
I should imagine that you might find yourself having to defend yourself from all sides.
Yeah, no, I have found that. A lot of people on the left have been annoyed that I present a lot of things that are sort of truths happening in London that they felt sort of undermined the case for Remain, such as the fact that most street sleepers in London are now from Eastern Europe, the fact that all around the A406 outside the Wicks or outside the B&Q you have 50 to 100 guys just touting for work there, none of whom are paid minimum wage, all of whom are going to get their work without insurance illegally. And that's just... But then again, also the right were very annoyed for me, because I did actually vote Remain and was very vocal about that on Twitter. They can't win. I think when you're not winning with either of the political camps, you're probably doing quite well.
I was struck by your access, in a way, because, well, I need to come back a step, I suppose, because the... The obvious London trait is that under any circumstances, including if you're nose-to-nose on the tube, you do not talk to other people. That is the golden rule. We all spot a foreigner because they speak to somebody that they don't know. So you're already stepping over that threshold. And in a way, I can see how the rather trite thing to observe would be the interaction between people at those junctions in their lives. You're talking about the patterns we have on the back of our iPhones.
Yeah.
And clearly we're going to run into people just for brief moments during the day. What I guess I'm more interested in is you getting to talk to some of those people where we're living in parallel with their lives, whatever that means, and you are just sort of nudging yourself onto the other side of the tracks for a while to see what... can you talk about some of those
how
kind of parallel setups?
How do I find people? Well, I'm interested in entry points that we don't see. And one of... they can be physical or they can be people. One of the entry points I'm really fascinated by is Hyde Park, just near Hyde Park Corner in Victoria Coach Station. This is the Ellis Island of contemporary London. That's what Victoria Coach Station is. It's our sort of hidden, miserable Ellis Islands. That's where the buses roll in from Eastern Europe, where thousands of migrants land every week to start a new life in Britain. And that's a fascinating place to go if you want to find people, you want to see people arriving, ask people like what are their first impressions of Britain and what's drawn them here. And one of the things that I was so interested about and I've been thinking about a lot is people are drawn to London because London in the villages of Eastern Europe or in the villages of Bangladesh or in Africa, it glows, it hums, it sort of stirs up dreams and promising to change you. And what's doing that? Like, what is it that's tempting these people here to what is a really hard, tough life with no good job guaranteed? I think the answer is actually TV, is that we live half in the brackets real world and half in the brackets virtual world. And if you are even in a kind of clapped out industrial town in Poland, you're going to be spending hours a day staring into screens. And what you're going to see in those screens is advertising or drama designed for the richest people in the richest parts of the developed world. So you know what the highest spec kitchen looks like. You know what London, what Paris, what New York looks like. You know what the interior of a super wealthy man's house looks like. And this is tempting you. It's tempting you to go. And you see this right across the world. And one of the most interesting reporting experiences I had in the former Soviet Union is I was travelling around in Tajikistan. And Tajikistan is by Human Development Index level. It's like an African country in Central Asia. It's a very, very poor and undeveloped country. It's really struggled ever since the Soviet Russian forces pulled out, effectively turning off the light. I remember being in an area called the Pamir Heights, and it's so high there is no vegetation. It's so high there are no birds. So high there are no animals. But there are people there who live off the road. And the people there are very good, kind people. They're very unused to travellers, and during the month I spent travelling through there, not once did I pay for a bed because people were willing to take me in. And one day I was staying with a family and they had brought a TV from a Chinese peddler. Put this TV in the house, I turned on the TV, it somehow connected to a satellite, I presume it was a Chinese satellite, I'm not entirely sure. And the show came up and it was called Sex and Tequila. It's an American show, and there were all these sort of hot, buff couples just sort of jiggling around in a swimming pool, drinking tequila, sharing these confessions of their lives. And this poor Tajik farming family that was watching it started going to me, America? Is that America? Is that America? And then I went off and travelled around in the mountains for some days, and I came back. And the family had been thrown into misery by this TV. The mother, she was devastated. Now she knew what an expensive kitchen looked like. The son, he was devastated. Now he knew what fun, what amazing lives people were having in earlier. And this show, Sex and Tequila, had ruined their balance in the place they were living, because it inserted the virtual reality of the richest people into the world into the daily lives of the poorest. And the youngest boy was already creating plans to leave, to go. The dream city in Central Asia is Moscow. But in Eastern Europe, in the subcontinent, in swathes of Africa and even South America, like, London is the dream city.
So how have we achieved that? Because as you've been talking, I've of course been thinking about the jungle situation over in Calais, and that question of why it is that so many people are passing through other Western countries to get to specifically London. So I understand the exporting of Western values, but why London?
Because London is one of the stars of TV. was London, the promise of London, the red buses, the wealth, the jobs, the whole advertising machine of London, how London is just so embedded in cinema and films. And the greatest characters in Western cinema are New York and London and Paris. It's not the actors, it's those cities, like, sort of lusciously lit at night, which really kind of grip the imagination. And people are coming for that. They want to be in it, they want to see it, they want to have it, they want to be part of it. And national myths, they haven't flowed in exactly the same way into the 21st century. They stir the heart much less. When I was living in the tunnels under Hyde Park Corner, TV came up very quickly, and there was one guy there who called himself the lawyer, who was sort of blubbing and was devastated, saying that he was tricked by TV, he was tricked by what he called the London state, he was tricked by the promise of the red buses of the city. And he had come from a small town in the Moldova region of Romania, and watching this TV that was on satellite, or these dubbed British comedies, which people watch all over the rest of the world, had made him long to come to London. And the reality that he'd found was that turning up like a 21st century Romanian Dick Whittington was sleeping on a cardboard box in the tunnels where we just were. And that was devastating for him. And I found that in lots of these stories as I went through this journey. It took 2 years to find these people and just really get inside their heads and learn how they see the world. That people come to London because they've watched almost all of the TV series that we watch. People are watching the rest of the world just in Amharic, or just in Arabic, or just in Turkish, or just in Polish. Because one of Britain's biggest exports is TV shows. People have arrived with all of that promise, and then the reality they find is like mopping up sick from the back of a minicab, or it's being the night cleaner in a giant glass skyscraper in the city of London, like hoovering 100 square metres of carpet like every night at 4 in the morning, because that's the only time that the bankers aren't there. And that kind of the pain and the clash of dreams and realities is really, really painful in 21st century migrant London. One of the things that I was often told, many of the people I met, this was the story that they experienced, that they'd come to London, they'd come to the Golden City, and the jobs that they ended up were jobs where they either cleaned it, they guarded it, they waited it, they built it, but they were never really there. People had come from Polish or Hungarian villages, and they found themselves in Mayfair, tiling the floor before getting the tube and the bus out to sort of unknown zones in outer London, living in sort of cramped doss houses where guys are sleeping 5 to 10 to a room. And that was a very painful experience.
While you've been talking, I don't know, listener, whether you've detected this from the variation in volume, but my guest is a very animated speaker. You've been moving back and forth and flailing your hands around and describing what you're talking about. And it got me thinking about the way in which you approach sketching somebody. You mentioned in the book that you're scribbling away on a notepad as you go, which I guess could be distracting. It also takes your eyes off the person to some degree. But if roles were reversed here and I was to do a sketch of you in your style, what would be the first things that I would be picking up on? What's your approach?
Well, a lot of the book was created via my phone, and all of the speech that you see in the book is, as far as is possible, a direct recording of what that person was saying. So the dialogue is actually what they said. It's not trimmed, it's not taken from a notebook. So I would record everything the person was saying, and I would encourage them to go on and on and on and on and on, kind of like what you're doing, say as much as possible. And whilst I was doing that, I would be trying to kind of draw them as much as possible in my notebook. Like, what are they wearing? How are they moving their hands? What kind of shoes are they wearing?
That's literally a picture of them.
Yeah, sometimes literally a picture of them, or just every single word I could use to describe how they were, and try and get lots of descriptions of what was going on around them as well, and how they related to space as well. And also how they related to me.
Because there's the long-known journalistic problem, potentially, particularly as we've moved into the age of dictaphones and audio recorders, that a notepad is a sort of... It reminds people of taking evidence, it reminds them of officialdom in some way. I wonder whether, particularly with the crew that you were talking to, whether that caused any problems.
People expect journalists to have a notebook, and if you just sit there recording it, just chilling out, people think you're not doing your job properly. So that can be... important sometimes. I actually use a notebook, it just helps me remember things. And like a lot of the first drafts of chunks of the book were actually written on my iPhone notes, like trying to fresh get like how am I seeing this. But I think recording and then typing out what the recording was, that's the skeleton of the book.
For dialogue and speech.
Yeah.
Moving back a step from that, though, and thinking about the first moment when your gaze lights on this person or that person, or maybe there's some other way by which you're introduced to them, how do you make your selections?
Well, like, entry points can be places, they can also be people. And if you're trying to get into these worlds that are not your world, you need guides. And one of the best kind of guides are translators, because in every police station, in every hospital, in every moment where people who've just arrived from Eastern Europe or Africa or wherever come into contact with the British state, there'll be a translator being there as the interface. And the translators are the people who map.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Migrant London and who know the best. And I was taken into these worlds through these guides. A lot of them I talk about in the book. And something I really wanted to do in the book was show as far as is possible like how journalism is done, and show people, well, the comedy, the mess of it, and also how a lot of the time it involves the grammar of a detective novel. Right, you've got to find ways to kind of infiltrate often these worlds where people don't want you to be. And so a lot of this book took place under cover, like living in DOS houses or going to sort of tout at illegal labour exchanges, the places that I couldn't have come with my notebook and my iPhone sort of waving it around to get the exact tone of people's voices.
And you sometimes launch in the, particularly in the descriptive passages, into something that's a little bit bigger than merely factual. You know, you're creating colour and space and a sense of the thing, creating an impression.
Well, it's all factual.
Well, I don't know, there's nuance added by your choice of language. I think you paint a picture.
But it's just how I... Yeah, so it's just... Well, I'm trying to describe the world and give it as much emotional content as I can. Like, there are a lot of my impressions thrown in there, and like my questions and my tensions and fears and doubts or whatever. So there's a lot of that in the mix. You know, the kind of stuff I like to read is non-fiction that reads like fiction, and I don't see any reason that journalism can't be sort of really beautiful and can't be an art form. So I'm trying to do that as well.
And it's been described as epic and various other things. I don't know whether you would... I mean, you couldn't not agree with that, could you? Of course it's epic. It's more than epic.
I like the word epic, though, because all of these people's journeys are epics. One of the reasons that I'm interested in immigrant storytelling is I'm Jewish and my grandparents are immigrants, and every immigrant family is its own epic of arrival, is its own Ulysses-style story of how grandpa or grandma got the passport and ended up in this country and not in that one and avoided on these dangerous, often incredibly dangerous treks to get here, huge dangers. And I grew up listening to these stories of escapes from the Nazis or migrations from India through the Middle East to London, and every time they were slightly different because these stories told by people getting increasingly the older. And every family of immigrant heritage has that suitcase full of stories, and it made me really interested to sort of hear everybody else's. And I think immigrant storytelling is different from the storytelling that people who don't have immigrant heritage have, because in their cases, stories are about a place. They're not about a journey. They're about a village. They're about a town. They're about a landscape. But if you're uprooted and you're coming to London, your origin myths revolve around the journey itself. And that was what made me want to sort of hunt out and find as many of these stories as possible.
I can't quite swallow what you've just said there. That doesn't sound right to me. No, and I'm not coming from the position that you are, of course. And I can understand what connects up the immigrant stories, the various immigrant stories. But is it necessarily the case that somebody who has not been through an immigrant story is necessarily connected to their place? I mean, I suppose one aspect of this would be, what would you call immigration? Because that relocation could happen over a much shorter distance or over an emotional distance from one cultural setting to another.
Of course, there should be a far finer gradient to it, but in the case of the book, it was people coming into this state and entering a new kind of world of law, a new world of usually language. That was the definition I use. But of course, there's elements of that experience that people come from different parts of the country and come to London.
People who've moved in from Milton Keynes seem quite culture shocked by Walthamstow, but I'm sure there's something slightly bigger to be said.
One of the characters, the people, they're not characters, they're real people still doing these jobs. One of the guys I profiled in the book was an Afghan who'd come on this whole journey to Europe. And his origin story of London, and that will be the origin story of his family, is British family that I'll have here, is this incredible journey of getting across the desert out of Pakistan and slipping through Iran and surviving going over the mountains when the Turks fired at the group, and then coming over the borders into Europe and having to sleep rough and
sounding a lot like Southern Trains.
I think if you come from Milton Keynes, you that kind of epic, maybe parts of it on Southern Trains, but it won't be quite the same scale. It won't be the family legend in the same way.
I think I agree with you. No, I think my concern was that thinking about all the... And I certainly see what you're saying about people who've migrated, but I just wonder whether there only being one reverse is accurate. I was thinking about how one sees the people who are on the other side of that experiential line, and whether they actually are a homogenous mass or not.
No, of course not, not at all. But what I wanted to do in this book was to give voices to the people who don't have their columnists, who don't have their kind of regular features in the Guardian or the Telegraph or their place in the media.
Why is it that these people are less well exposed?
Well, either they don't want people to see them, in the case of the super rich, like a lot of my journey went into sort of infiltrating the world of the Qatari and Russian super rich, and they don't want people to know how they live. People who work for them, they make them sign these non-disclosure agreements, so they can't give interviews without being legally prosecuted for sometimes up to decades afterwards. Or, they're very poor, and they're very poor, and they live in places that are forgotten, or in roles that are forgotten by the rest of society.
Well, so that sounds like a much bigger challenge then. How did you get it mixed up with those guys, the very wealthy?
Well, my first book was a study of Putin and Putin's Russia, so that gave me a lot of the connections in the inns, and I actually got to meet some oligarchs, including Berezovsky before he died in these sort of mysterious circumstances. Just around there, actually. Down street, just there's where I met Berezovsky. And so that gave me an in into that world.
And yet they didn't demand the same secrecy of you.
Well, a lot of them did, which is why they didn't turn up in the book. The people in the book are the people I managed to get their stories out. There were so many hundreds of people that I tried to get in. Either their stories weren't good enough, or I realised halfway through they were making them up, or the first half of the story was great, the second half was boring, or they just wouldn't do it. So the book could have been five times the size if everyone had been in.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, now we're back to what we started with, which was the issue of the selection on the part of the journalist.
Well, when I began the process of doing this book, I had this sort of anthropologist's checklist. Rich, poor, from Russia, from Poland, from Afghanistan, tick, tick, tick. And in the process of doing that, I realised, no, this is not the way you're going to reveal the city. That's not actually how you'll see the most of it, and the readers will see the most of it, which is that London is in fact more different, I realise, doing this. If you're 15, 18, 25, 50, you've got dementia, you're 90, the way you are in the rhythm of your life shapes more how London will be different. And so the book is structured along this arc of life. Like, it begins with people who've just arrived, because immigration is a bit like birth, it's a new life. And then it follows that arc of people trying to get work, people falling in love, people succeeding, people failing, people being transformed, people making it, people having kids, people going through the difficult process of raising kids when you're not originally from this country, people getting old and people dying. The book ends in a mosque in Leighton, in Death, where I managed to interview a gentleman there who prepares and washes the bodies before burial, who was telling me the sense of summation he felt of being the guardian of these people's lives as they prepared to depart. So that became one element of the selection process. And the other element of the selection process, I realised, is I interviewed so many people that didn't make it into the book, and often I'd meet people who I'd been told had incredible stories and they just couldn't express them. I'd be like, well, how did you feel when you arrived? Well, I felt good. And how has it been the next 6 months? Oh, it was difficult. And then I realised, no, what you're looking for is not just people who've had these experiences, you're looking for storytellers. And this was quite a frightening experience doing the book, because I realised that the storytelling ability is random. It's randomly distributed. Some of the best storytellers I've ever met are tube pickers, picking up kind of packets of crisps and evening standards on the Bakerloo line, or they're plasterers, working out on the touting spots. And so all of the people in the book, they have that in common, that they're storytellers. And I only realised that's what I've been doing at the end.
That's interesting. When I'm thinking about fiction, you have exactly the same issue, that it's very difficult to write a story from the point of view of a taciturn person for obvious reasons. Does that self-selection spin things in a particular direction? Does it mean that you end up with people with a flair for the dramatic?
One of the chapters in this book involves me discussing the nature of stories with one of the guys that I profiled, and he actually challenged me on that point. When if you're looking for stories, you're never going to meet anyone who's going, oh, I had a great lunch and it was good, thanks very much. That does to a degree, yeah, but not in terms of happy or sad, not in terms of success or failure. People are in fact more proud to tell stories of their success, their achievements, their loves, than they are of their failures. But I think it does strip out a lot of the boredom that most life is composed of, for the most part.
Can I chuck two questions at you at once, although they're not closely related? One is, I wanted to ask you about the dimension of truth in what you're doing.
Sure.
Or what you were doing, and how you not only handled presenting yourself, but also, I guess we've covered it already, but the different ways that truth manifests itself in your writing, how you truly represent somebody, how truthfulness, do you nudge the story along a little bit if you're missing that crucial sentence or something that you feel would help, or is there any leeway there? So that whole issue of truth, yeah, would be one thing, but also to what extent you feel a duty of care. And I've got in my mind specifically, if you've got somebody at a fairly low ebb and you're asking them to rehearse that low ebb and then you're going to bugger off, is there a way in which you approach that.
Well, and also there's an element of how do you know... One of the things that I found doing this is you ask people to tell you the stories of their lives. Often you find they don't quite add up. And one of the... That was an issue of truth that I found. Often I started profiling people, running up there, down our lives, and suddenly I realised that things weren't making sense, that some things couldn't have happened. So in terms of trust, one of the people who are in the book, these people that I have trusted, and that I trust them, and I trust these stories, that's why they're there. In terms of...
Were they right to trust you?
Well, most of them have the book. Most of them are very, very happy with it. Mm-hmm. So,
were you exactly as you packaged yourself?
Well, there are several chapters in the book where you can't access those places as a journalist. So if you to go and live in the doss houses of Far East London, I couldn't live there as a journalist. So when I went into that world, I had to take on this line. I had to pretend that I was a labourer from Ukraine. I speak Russian, and this allowed me to slip in. So they thought I was a labourer from Ukraine, and they were giving me advice about like how to improve my English and what kind of bosses I would want to get. So were they right to trust me? In one sense, no. It was stupid of them to trust me, even though there's no way they would have told. But were they right to trust me in the wider sense? People I know about these shocking Dickensian conditions in which people like them live, and they're not happy about living in. I think they were. And one of the things that really shocked me, and that not been reported that many other places, is just the scale of how in poor Eastern European London, health and safety is optional. Minimum wage is optional. And in order to show that, I had to kind of go undercover and assume these other identities. And I write a lot in the book about what that was like and about how I had to train myself in order to carry these lies and these covers. I think that in secret policemen, they call it like the legend, how that worked and what that was like.
I'll ask you about the duty of care as well, of course. But
well, one of the ways in which I took that very seriously is I didn't want to put anybody's full names in there. I didn't want them to be Googleable. And it was one chap who requested that. And then I thought, well, that's a very good idea. So anybody who wanted to be in the book, I went, can I take a photo of you to show the people reading the book that these people are real and this is what they are and this is who they are? But I thought full names, I didn't want their names to be sort of searchable online in case they were trying to get a job elsewhere. So that's one point that I took.
But what about the emotion? I know, having interviewed people about their things that matter to them, and sometimes things that aren't so such positive experiences, that when the interview comes to an end, actually they can be quite delicate, quite vulnerable. I don't know whether you found that in what you were doing.
Well, I think if you believe in journalism, you believe in the purpose of interviewing them. Mm.
Oh, yeah, I'm not suggesting drawing back from the questions. I'm thinking about how you handled the interview and the post-interview, and what duty of care you felt towards the interviewee.
Well, sometimes it's upsetting if someone's told you that these stories are going into a very dark place. But people relate to you in different ways as a journalist. Sometimes people relate to you as the state. You've come down from some sort of high place and you're here, and they've been waiting their whole lives to complain about the British state, and they're going to tell you. Sometimes they treat you as like a stranger on the train. You're like a sort of mysterious friend. They found you and they're going to tell you their secrets, in the sense that you're going to disappear now. And this was a chance for them to offload the stories that have been on them for a long time. Sometimes, especially with like very rich or super rich people, they didn't really understand what an interview was, and they'd be going, what's the right answer to this question? What do you want me to say? I thought it was a theatre play. And often I found with people who have very difficult, badly paid jobs, they'd never told their stories before. It was a very magical and quite touching experience to have people tell their whole life stories, and to see as they realised these connections that were there and they hadn't seen these patterns. More often than not, when I ask people to tell their whole stories of how they got from Ghana or Nigeria or Afghanistan or Ukraine to London, often there was this incredible flash of satisfaction that they'd surmounted these huge dangers or they'd survived these horrible twists. And that was quite beautiful to see.
Tell me a bit more about becoming Ukrainian.
Well, one of the ways that I did this undercover, and I've got a film in which I do it again, coming out on Vice in about a month, is I have a Romanian friend, and I went in with him. He made the calls, phoning up and saying, hi, I'm here for work, I'm here, I've got a mate, he doesn't speak Romanian, he's from Ukraine. We would go in, and the most important things we went through were haircut and were getting the right clothes and looking the part. And I would be there just behind him. He navigated through, and he would often be the kind of interface, the interface with them. And the reason that I chose a Ukrainian personality is, and we went into these Romanian places, is firstly is that there were only going to be Romanians there, and then not an expert on Ukraine or what's what. And also in the case that there was a Ukrainian there, half of Ukraine speaks Russian, half of it speaks Ukrainian. You could just pretend to be from the other one.
Clever.
So a lot of sort of cunning went into this. But the whole process made me very frightened about clothes. And I hadn't realised how powerful clothes were, what they say. When you, if you go and you work on these building sites, you wear those Eastern European clothes, people just treat you differently. You feel it. You sense it. And that's made me realises a lot more power in kind of clothes than I realised before, and be quite frightened of them.
Yeah, that's an interesting word you're using there, frightened. What have you got in your mind?
I just didn't realise how clothes could shape your relationship with a whole society.
It seems in some way quite obvious, doesn't it, that people treat... Oh, we've all seen the YouTube experiment where the same guy goes into McDonald's and asks for a bit of ketchup or something, once dressed as a vagrant and once dressed as a yuppie.
It's like one thing to know that, and it's another to like actually feel it, to feel those eyes kind of burn on you when you're doing it. And that really rammed home that point to me. That was a shock. Like, I knew it notionally. I didn't know that's how it felt.
Are you playing around the edges of a fear that's already there in you in some way? You mentioned the immigrant story. I wonder if you're testing the boundaries of the experience in some way.
Well, maybe subconsciously. I didn't know. But a lot of it came out of my ideas about journalism and what a journalist should and shouldn't be doing, and about what I wanted to read, and how I think that there's just too much comment about Britain and in British journalists over there. More and more commentators, they're getting bigger and bigger and bigger. They have their own YouTube channels. They're leaving the Conservative Party or rejoining it. And they don't do reporting. And when they do reporting, they do it with these preconceived notions, which are basically party political. And there's not enough going in with an open mind just to listen to people, to get the real stories of real people.
You talked about the journey that people are making through their lives.
Yeah.
Where are you at, as far as your journey goes? Because you've clearly travelled a load. Are you now at the stage where you're starting to identify with one particular place, or are you just setting out?
A very difficult question. I went through like a long phase of like travelling around in Siberia and South America and the Middle East, and wanting to go to as many cities as possible. And I realised that I was basically living on maps, and that I was living on this pin that was moving around, and I was getting this enormous thrill out of just seeing my geolocate in the middle of Siberia. And actually I was learning very little, because you can do it so quickly now, and I've got a lot more into like getting to know cities deeply now, and to going to the same places and going deep further and further down. I think it's very easy to like city break about and business trip about and think you're travelling, but actually you're not travelling anywhere, because you're going to hotels that all look the same, you're meeting other people just like you who all doing the same thing. In my case, it'd be other journalists who write about kind of politics and societies, it could be other people who work in IT, it could be other people who work in business development, it could be other people who work in banking or law or tourism or whatever. And I think that's an illusion. And I think that in terms of like getting further away from yourself and your groove, you can actually do it more by going down. So I've started going a lot more to a few cities and going very deep in them and trying to know them better. Like, one is Paris and the other is Tel Aviv.
And are either of those the next project?
I would like to write about Israel one day, but there's a tradition in Judaism which with a mystical form of knowledge called Kabbalah, which according to the old sort of rabbinic adage, you're not supposed to go into this form of mysticism until you're sort of age 40 and you have 3 children and you're sort of settled down. The reason being that you can that it's a sort of thing that young men would often get wrong. And I think in writing about Israel, I'd like to sort of come to that from not from the perspective of somebody who's 28, but somebody who's older. I think that there's a lot that I don't get now, and I will only get then.
So what is the next project?
Well, so I'm thinking a lot about the nature of books, and I mentioned Paris, and I'm very interested in France, but I'm wondering if whether or not you can still have news books by journalists in the 21st century. Because I think, contrary to what a lot of other journalists think, I think people are better informed than they now than they were before. Because of Wikipedia, it's the golden age of the 5,000-word essay. And I think people are well informed of the headline issues about what's going on in France. I'm trying to work out whether those are a thing of the past, like the foreign correspondence, my last 5 years in Russia and my last 5 years in France. Increasingly edging towards that, but I'm not sure. So I'm still thinking.
And in the meanwhile, caught up in the echo chamber that follows any publication.
Well, it was cool to talk about Brexit and debate all of that. I was expecting those issues to become more important. I wasn't expecting this whole very emotional trauma the country went through. Even the victors are traumatised.
Mm. That's true. They do seem traumatised. Nor do they want to talk about anything. The true sign of a trauma victim, they are clammed up. They don't want to talk about it. Very peculiar. We're going to come to a close, though. Our time is all but up. A quick reminder of your several titles.
My titles?
Yeah, not Lord. I mean your books. That's hanging around the super rich, getting carried away.
Well, maybe it could be Professor Judah or Rabbi Judah. My book on London is called This Is London, and my book on Russia is called Fragile Empire.
I know you've got a great series there. It should be called This Is Russia, and then the next one, This Is France.
Yeah, I do like the name. Yeah,
I can only recommend the prose, and thank its author, Ben Judah.
Thank you.
And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Ben Judah. Thanks to James Douglas and Bernie Barkley. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.